This is a BICOM podcast. I'm Richard Pater, the director of BICOM here in Israel, and it's the 19th of February. We are 2 weeks away from Israel's general election, and away from our usual discussions about security and diplomacy, today we're going to discuss some of the domestic issues on the socio-economic front. I can think of no better expert than Professor Avi Weiss, of the president of the Taub Center for Social Policy and Social Policy Studies here in Israel. It's the leading socio-economic think tank and is apolitical, non-partisan, giving advice to the government and recommendations within the sphere of socio-economic policy. Professor Weiss himself is an expert in applied economics and industrial organization, and in the past has served as the chief economist in the Israeli Antitrust Authority, as well as the chairman of the economics department in Bar-Ilan University. Professor Weiss, thank you very much for joining me.
It's a pleasure to be here.
If I can ask, and kind of in the context of the elections, what are the economic costs of the repeat elections and the political paralysis that we've had over the last year?
Well, of course, there's the direct cost of the elections. They are not cheap in and of themselves to run the entire election campaigns, and the number of people needed in order to be able to cover the polls and everything else that's needed. You know, you're talking about many hundreds of millions of shekels, which is a significant cost in a country that could use that money for other types of uses. And of course, this is our third within just about a year. That's a lot by any standard. That's a lot, and we don't even know that this is going to end it, because we don't know that the results in this election are going to come out much different than the others. So there is that direct cost. There's the indirect cost, of course, in that in Israel, the election day is a day is a sabbatical. People don't work on that day, and as a result, there's the lost income from the people who aren't working on that day. There are many other costs, though, because there's the whole issue of being in a year, fiscal year, in which we haven't actually passed a budget. The result of not having a budget is that you're basically using a budget based on last year's budget, which means that new plans really can't be made, that the big changes can't be made. And that has a general effect on the entire economy and the ability of different types of committees to work. So some types of committees will, you know, not be able to get their work done because they just don't have the budget in order to do that. So it does have all kinds of costs. I don't have an estimate of how much that's going to cost the economy, but it is a cost, and you really do need to get this over with.
Are there particular sectors that are affected by kind of the lack of fiscal planning?
I think it's really just across the board. I don't think it's anything very specific to one or the other, but it's just everywhere is feeling it.
Looking ahead, presuming there will be a government formed, hopefully after this close election or eventually, what are the most significant economic challenges that any new government will face?
Oh, there are always, of course, many. So let's just start on the macro level. On the macro level, one of the challenges that the government faces, one of the biggest ones, is the growing deficit. We know that Israel was very, very fiscally frugal over a very long period, resulting in a high credit rating of a AA, which allowed it to borrow money internationally at very good interest rates. Now, when you do that, then of course you can service your international debt much more cheaply, so you have much more left over for other uses that you can do with those monies. Past couple of years saw a couple of agreements which raised fiscal expenditure very significantly for now and for a long time going forward. And the result is that you increased the deficit from about 1.9% in 2018 to about 2.9% in 2019, and it's expected to go up to close to about 4.5% even. It's really increased very, very significantly. And that's going to be a problem looking forward. All the governments, anybody who comes into power, is going to have to do something about that deficit, because you can't really allow that credit rating to go back down. It's just going to be too costly to the country. Now, the problem is, as you saw, all the political parties put out their economic stances, what they want to do, and everybody wants to do a whole lot, but nobody really is going to say where that money's going to come from, because to do that, you have to pay for it somehow. So the only way to actually do all those things that people are talking about is to raise taxes significantly, but nobody obviously wants to talk about raising taxes. So we're not sure what's going to happen. We don't know whether they're going to end up raising taxes or lowering services and not doing many of the things that they're talking about, because you can't get both ways. You can't grab it from both ends, and we cannot live with a deficit that keeps growing. So let's go on to employment on the other end. Education and employment. We all know that we have a couple of parts of the population
that relatively have lower rates of employment and or lower rates of education. So if you start with the ultra-Orthodox in Israel. So the ultra-Orthodox are the Haredim in Israel. We know that the men tend to not get a good education past sixth grade. They're not studying math, they're not studying languages, they're not studying computers, they're not studying sciences. They're basically just studying religious studies. The result is that those who do eventually want to get into the labor force have very low marketable skills. And the result of that is that their ability to actually get, you know, reasonable salaries or to contribute to the country from a productivity perspective is going to be very, very limited. Some of them will go and get training later on, but not everybody can do that. And that's hard to do at a later age, especially languages, especially learning English for the first time at the age of 25 is a very difficult point to start that at, especially when you already have a family and kids, and it's very, very hard to do. We know that their employment rate is very, very low. It's much higher than it used to be, but still, it's somewhere only around 50%. The government had set a goal for 2020 of 63%. They're nowhere near that that goal. So that's a real challenge that faces the economy, and especially with the Haredi population being a population that has a lot of children, that is growing, that's a problem that will become worse unless you have a change going on there. And there is some change happening. There are more types there's a lot of work going into trying to give them better training, trying to get them better off, but it's still very, very too early to see whether it's going to have that much of an effect with respect to the Haredi men. So that's one of those we're going to have to wait and see what happens. The one that we less have to wait and see what happens is the Arab-Israeli women. Arab-Israeli women, the government had set a goal of 41%. They had been at 20% back in 2003. 25% when that goal was set in 2010, but the goal was for 41%. They're currently very close to 40%. So it looks like the goal of 41% in 2020, if not completely reached, will be very close to being reached. And that's really a wonderful, wonderful outcome. And the goal set for the next stage is over 50%. So we expect that to happen also, because the level of education and the types of education that the Arab-Israeli women are getting has improved very, very significantly. The difficulty there is employment afterwards, because there are difficulties for Arab-Israelis to get into parts of the high-tech industries, in particular the security parts of that. Mm-hmm. So a company like Rafael that deals in direct security will not take anybody who is not in the Israeli army. And therefore, their ability to get jobs there don't exist. Now, that's a set of plants that exist up in the north of the country where most of them are located. So that's actually reasonable type of employment for them, but they can't get that. There are also issues of questions of discrimination against Arab Israelis in terms of employment opportunities. That's something that will probably exist a lot less in big firms than in small firms, but can also limit the amount of opportunity available to them. So the challenge there is creating opportunities of employment in areas that are close to the places that they live. So putting together employment centers for even high-tech type of employment centers inside of the villages of the north of the country, which will allow for the opportunities to be there, that people will see that, you know, if I go and get these studies, if I go and work hard during my elementary school, during high school, and learn computers and learn mathematics and learn sciences, I will have a really good possibility of getting a good job afterwards. That's going to be super important to that. And the success of that will eventually affect the Arab-Israeli men also, the young men. The problem in the Arab-Israeli with Arab-Israeli men is a different type of issue. The issue is not that they're not working. It's that the types of jobs that they're doing tend to be in a lot of construction, a lot of manufacturing, which are very, very physically difficult, a lot of wear and tear. And the result of that is that they tend to retire at early ages. So therefore, they're getting an income, they're working, but at young ages, and then they're leaving early. So that actually affects them, obviously affects them towards their pension, towards, you know, the entire period of their not working anymore, and affects their families very greatly. So the ability to integrate more modern types of works, more high-tech type of works into that population also is something that can free that up and allow them to work, you know, the same lifespan as other people tend to work. So those are a few of the challenges. If you were to move over to the health sector, you might move over to the situation with respect to the number of beds inside of Israel in hospitals. The number is at the very, very, very low end of other developed countries. It's all the way at the bottom. I think second from the bottom. In OECD countries. While there is some sense in that, because Israel is a younger population than you have in most other countries, so therefore correcting for that, it's not quite as extreme as without correcting for that, but still the number is low. And one of the things that you find if you look at Israeli hospitals is that they look like they're really efficient, because the occupancy rates are really high. The last number I saw was 94%. It was up at 96%. That's one of the highest in all the developed countries. So there aren't empty beds inside the hospitals. And the other thing is that the length of stay, the average length of stay, is one of the shortest inside of the OECD countries. It's a little bit over 5 days. And that means that people are being released quickly. Well, that sounds great. But we know that diseases are cyclical during the year, that people get sicker during the winter, they get more pneumonia and more flus and things along those lines. Especially elderly need to be able to admit to the hospital when they're in not good shape. And now if you had empty beds, you would have where to put them. If you had people staying for a long time, you'd be able to let people go maybe more quickly and have where to put the people who come into the hospital. But when you have neither one of those happening, then basically you end up with a situation where you have difficulty finding a place for somebody who needs to be hospitalized. So you end up with a lot of people inside the emergency rooms for a long time, and you end up with a situation where people are being housed in hallways, because that's where they can find room to put a bed for somebody. So those are difficulties within that sector. If you move a little bit towards, I know I'm giving you a lot, but that's okay. You asked a big question, so it's your own fault. to quote Tom Lehrer, if you didn't want me to start, if you didn't want to hear this all, you should never have let me begin. If you look at education, the education sector, so what you're seeing is you're seeing the latest of something that's very concerning, nobody knows where this came from, the latest PISA exams. The latest PISA exams showed a widening gap between the Jewish and the Arab populations, with the Jewish population actually being above the OECD mean, but the Arab population not just being below, being a lot below and dropping very significantly. And and that's very worrisome, and nobody knows why that's happening, in particular because it flies in the face of everything else that's been going on. We know that there's been actually an improvement in education results, aside from the PISA exam, in the Arab-Israeli sector, that more are graduating, more getting matriculating, getting the bagrut, more getting the bagrut at a level that can get them into college, more going to college and university. They're going more into other subjects, not just education anymore. They're going into other things also. So you see a lot of improvement going on, and then suddenly these latest results really hit everybody. It took a lot of people by surprise, and I haven't really heard any really good explanation about why it's so different than the other types of exams.
Is this just a one-off annual survey, or is it part of a trend?
There has been a trend there is definitely a trend in that the PISA exams are the Arab population is doing worse than the Jewish population is doing. But this particular fall was particularly sharp, and that was what you had the grades, average grades increasing for a long time until about 2014 or 2015, and then it started going down a little bit. And just this last one was a big fall in the Arab Israeli society and Arab Israeli students, and you're not sure why that actually happened.
Well, if there's anyone that will know, we'll come back to you for answers when you have a better understanding.
Well, we are certainly looking into it, but we don't yet know the answers to why that happened.
If I can ask just one last question, I mean, as this think tank that you lead offers advice or recommendations to various government bodies. Kind of, what are the standout recommendations that you're making at the moment in specific fields?
Well, we don't really offer specifically advice or recommendations, because once we do that, one of the things that makes our think tank very different than other think tanks is that we don't play to any political agenda at all. And the problem with making strong recommendations that will usually play into this person's political agenda and against the other ones. And the result of the way that we deal with that, with what we do, is that we have all doors open for us. In other words, all the parties come and speak to us, because they all know they're going to get an honest review of what's happening. So we will tend to term them more in terms of options, and we'll talk about the different issues. But in each field, you know, there are different things we will talk about. If we're talking about welfare issues, then we might talk about the importance of changing, let's say, the early childhood program to allow for people to get higher returns on their investments. I'm not sure you know that program, but it's a very important program that was started in 2017. We will talk about the importance of social protection and helping the weaker populations, the gap that's opened up between the median wage and the amount of protection that a person will get who can't work. We will talk to them about issues in the education, obviously, the things that we talked about before. We'll talk to them about the hospital situation and mention that there are big gaps between the different areas in Israel with respect to how many hospital beds are available per 100,000 people, or how long it takes to get to a facility where you can get medical assistance. And we'll talk about those differences and try to direct them and say, you know, so if you look at the things people are talking about starting new hospitals, they understand that it might be more important to start them in the north and the south than to put another hospital where you already have a lot of hospital beds existing. So in each and every field, it will be different issues. And of course, the issue of the deficit is something we talk to them a lot about. And also the issues of competition in Israel, which includes opening up the market to more competition from outside of Israel.
Fascinating. Professor Weiss, thank you very much indeed.
Always a pleasure.